Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
Joy 94.9, Friday morning show with Leo. When we think of the Australian music industry, it's hard to go past Mr. Michael Gnitsky. He's been a very influential supporter of Australian music from his days running Mushroom Records to now heading Frontier Touring Company. He's led an interesting life, a fascinating life, and it's finally been documented in a new book from freelance journalist, radio broadcaster, record label owner, and band manager Stuart Coop. Joining me on the line from Sydney, welcome to Joy, Stuart.
Thank you, Leah.
Now, firstly, you've been in the industry a long time yourself. Give us a quick snapshot of, I guess, your career and when you first met Michael Gnitsky.
In a nutshell, I've been writing about music for about 40 years. It's a long time, isn't it? I've spent about 13 years as a broadcaster in Sydney on FBI radio. I've managed the Hoodoo Gurus and Paul Kelly. I've promoted concert tours by Lucinda Williams and Harry Dean Stanton and Guy Clark and a lot of people. I worked as a publicist for The Clash and The Cramps when they came to Australia. So I've had a record label called Laughing Outlaw Records for the last 16 years. But I met Michael Gnitsky for the first time about 1984 or 1985. And that was when I was managing Paul Kelly, who was effectively out of the contract with Mushroom Records after his first two albums. So I was around Paul when he recorded Post, and then I redid his contracts with Michael Gnitsky and Mushroom Records. So that was the beginning. And I, as I mentioned in the book, when I first met Gnitsky, I was completely intimidated, terrified, nervous. You know, he's a very charismatic, powerful, in-your-face character. And it was hard going trying to match wits with him in those days.
Now, I've actually never met Michael personally, but I've been at a few events where he's been at, and I witnessed that notorious bark.
Yes, look, he's a larger-than-life individual. He's got a very legendary non-attention span. Mm-hmm. You know, he's loud, he's very opinionated, but he's, you know, that's not meant to sound like they're bad things. He's also crazily passionate about music, and one of the things that, you know, I've always liked about Michael is just that intense flag waving for Australian music. And that's something he's been doing since the late 60s, early 1970s. And he'll still do it about, you know, newer bands like Temper Trap and the Rubens and people that that have come across his path or he's working with. Yeah, but yes, look, he's one of the last of those great, you know, music industry characters that they just don't. They don't seem to make any more, so that makes him a fabulous subject to write about. But you know, it was interesting to try. And there's a lot of mythology surrounding Michael. There's and pretty much everyone has a Michael Gnitsky story. So you know, a lot of what I spent the 18 months doing was trying to unravel the fact from the fiction. Try and get a perspective on his career. I didn't want to write a book. It's not an authorized book. You know, I didn't want to write a book that was just 350 pages of Michael is wonderful, Michael is, you know, perfect, because he's not and he hasn't been. But, you know, he's also had some very, very major achievements in the music industry in this country.
What I love about Michael is obviously when he started Mushroom Records in 1972, he's very loyal, very passionate about music, as you said. I like the old days where you had a band or an artist and you nurtured them. There was no like, okay, have a number one, have a top 10 or you're going to be dropped. The Split Enz had, I think their fifth album was a number one, but the four albums before that did okay, but not amazingly well. But he stuck by the band and he nurtured them and he stood by them and he really believed in Aussie music.
Yes, loyalty and persistence are very big things with Michael, and you're absolutely right. With Split Enz, he stuck with them way after I really believe any other record label would have done. And they're far from being an isolated example in, you know, the four decades of Mushroom Records. That that, you know, if he believes in someone, believes in an artist, he will just have that blind faith that they will turn around and that they will be successful. He's not always right, but he certainly gives them the chance. And that carries through to the people that he has working for and with him. I mean, I was surprised during the course of the book to find out how many people that are still working at Dundas Lane and Albert Park in Melbourne, you know, have been there for 20, 25, 30, and in some cases 35 years. I mean, he's very, very loyal to those staff people, and they're loyal to him as well. And the other thing that dawned on me during the course of writing the book is just, you know, unlike any other record company I can think of in Australia and possibly even globally, Michael has always promoted and surrounded himself with very, very strong, opinionated, talented women, and he's given them free rein to sign artists, nurture artists, and work with artists in a way that, sadly, is still pretty much unheard of in other, you know, elements of the music industry. So that loyalty is across the board. You know, I mean, if you're not on Team Gadisky, it's not a great place to be, but you really have to screw some things up, either as a staff member or as an artist, to lose that loyalty from Michael.
Because if you do the dirty and you double-cross him, watch out.
Look, if you do, but, you know, I mean, to his credit, he'll probably let you double-cross him three times, but, you know, by the time you hit the fourth time, it's all over. I mean, you know, he also has a history of being very, very forgiving. You know, there's one instance in the book with someone that he worked with for many, many years, and you know, and I know he turned, you know, a blind eye, as the cliche goes, to activities for a long time before it was just rubbed in his face one too many times, and he had no choice but to act. But people around Michael really adore and admire him. He's I don't think, having dealt with him during the course of this book, that I'd necessarily want to be one of his staff members. I think to cope with his erratic attention span and his unpredictable movements and the chaos and the amount of business he attempts to do, I think it would drive most people crazy. I mean, it was driving me crazy. And then I just got to a certain point and I just went, okay, it's okay. Don't get too stressed about it. I just worked out that for every 10 times he said he was either going to ring or we were going to have a meeting, nine of those meetings or phone calls would not happen or be rescheduled, and one of them would. And once I got to the point where I just assumed that things were going to change, everything was fine. You know, I lost the stress factor, and I just went, no, well, that's just Michael. You know, I'd speak to his office and I go, well, where is he? And they go, well, he's in the car. We're holding a ticket for him to go to London, but he says he might go to Tokyo. And then someone just rang and they said they're due to see him in Brisbane tomorrow. You know, and it's just like, and invariably he'd end up in none of those places. So he'd pick somewhere else. You know, and his final corrections for this book, which were literally, because I was writing right up to the time it went to the printer. I mean, his lawyer called me on the day that this book was going to go to the printers, Leo, and said, look, can you hold on for a couple of hours? Because I gave him the right to correct the book for factual errors, but not for any interpretations or anything. Yeah. And his lawyer says, look, he's got a couple of factual things he really wants to talk to you about. And I said, okay. I said, so he's going to call. And I said, well, he's actually in a plane now. He's left London. He's on his way back to Melbourne. He'll land in Dubai at 2:30 this afternoon. He'll ring you then.
He'll ring you.
Oh, yes. So he rang at 2:30, and he had two very important things that, you know, things that he had to discuss about this book. Right, this is what we got down to. First of all, he said, look, mate, on page 57 of the book, you mentioned how I bought a Jaguar in 1973. He said, that's correct. But it wasn't new. You've got to change that. It was secondhand. It was a long time before I bought a new car. And then he drew my attention to the fact that earlier in the football season, he'd said some less than complimentary things about how he thought St Kilda would go this season. And he said that they were playing a little better than what he expected and that some of the team would probably read this book. So could I go a little bit softer on his observations on St Kilda this football season?
Oh, God.
So we were across the really important stuff. I said, so you don't really want to talk to me about, you know, the $40 million sale to Rupert Murdoch in News Limited, or you don't want to, you know. So I've just worked on the principle that if we're down to correcting the purchase of a Jaguar in 1973 has been secondhand and not new, then that means that I've got the majority, if not all of the major facts correct.
And you mentioned before, Stuart, that woman working at Mushroom Records, and one case was with Kylie Minogue, because obviously Michael didn't sign Kylie. It was actually Amanda Pellman who signed Kylie Minogue. And Michael, I guess, didn't realise the fact until he got to the UK. His nieces were talking about the show called Neighbours and said, oh, we must sign Kylie. So that was a kind of a weird situation where they had this girl from the show who wanted to be a singer. 28 years later, I don't think even Michael would have guessed that she's this huge global icon.
I don't think anyone would have. And I think when we mention Amanda, that goes back to what I mentioned earlier. You know, the fact that Michael was undecided. You know, it wasn't something, you know, Mushroom had been going since the early 1970s. They were, at that point, you know, an uber hip, very credible rock with a capital R label in this country. And so suddenly he gets this demo from someone, as you say, from, you know, a young actor from Neighbours who doesn't have any track record as a singer. They've got this cassette tape with a version of Locomotion, which had been a hit 7,000 years earlier for Little Eva. And he doesn't really know, and it's completely out of kilter with what Mushroom's all about. So he does throw it in the direction of Amanda Pellman and goes, look, you know, what do you think? And that's a really great thing about Michael. He doesn't know, but he goes, okay, well, you tell me what you think. If you think it's something we should be pursuing, run with it and let's go with it. And it was a little bit later, you know, as you said, when he heard from his sister's kids in the UK, and also when Kylie started to take off, that he, you know, fully embraced what was going on, and then with a phenomenal commitment. And people say, oh, you know, that's a bad thing, Michael wasn't. And I into Kylie, and I go, well, you don't necessarily expect the head of a record label with a huge roster to be across everything on the label. You know, and at the time, there was every chance that Kylie wouldn't have worked, but it did work. And it was, you know, and also, you know, what I found interesting doing the research for the book was just, I mean, Michael was not alone. There was almost a palace revolt at Mushroom headquarters when the news circulated that they were contemplating signing, you know, not only an actor from a soap opera, but a dance pop artist, because this flew in the face of everything that Mushroom was all about. So you, not only have you got an uncertain Michael, you've got a very certain staff running around going, no, this is the end of our credibility. No, this will be the end of us. No, no one with any credibility will ever come near us anymore. We don't do dance music. We don't do pop music. You know, we do rock and singer-songwriters and people who write their own songs. And we do Hunters and Collectors and the Models and Paul Kelly and the Sunny Boys and the Machinations. And, of course, we do Jimmy Barnes. So, you know, Kylie totally stood out at that point of time. It's been very, very different from what you would have expected to be a release on Mushroom Records.
With everything Michael has achieved, some things haven't worked. His wish was to have a number one in the US. That didn't happen. His success, I guess, in the States, launching a label, didn't happen. In the UK, a bit of success with the likes of Garbage and Peter Andre, of all people, really took off in the UK, and I guess was a bit of success for Mushroom UK, but it wasn't a lasting success.
No, I mean, it's It's not through lack of trying, and I think he's had at various times the artist with the ability to make it overseas. I think you have to put it down to, it's not so much the case now, but way back when, you know, I was working with Paul Kelly, and then when there were Hunters and Collectors and a lot of the Sports and Joe Joseph and the Falcons and Hunters and Collectors, you know, it's not like they didn't have the ability. The tyranny of distance certainly worked against Australian artists in those days. The cost of international travel, the fact that, you know, they couldn't create a situation where they could, you know, live and base themselves in the United States or in the UK. Well, I think sometimes, you know, it may have just, Split Enz definitely had a chance. Skyhooks had a chance. Maybe in that respect, Michael has just been just a tad unlucky. You know, I find it amusing that you know, there are three things that Michael has always wanted in life. And he's you know, three big things, and he's achieved one of them. And the one that he has achieved, well, let's go, the two he hasn't are a number one record in America. Mm. He's also wanted to be financially involved with a horse that wins the Melbourne Cup. He's had a horse that's come third but hasn't had that. But the one thing he has achieved is he wanted a hole-in-one in golf, and he has actually achieved that. And I'm at pains to point out to people who roll their eyes, I say, no, it wasn't mini golf. You know, it was actually on a real golf course, apparently. So, but no, one of the things that I love about Michael is that desire to have a number one in America, I think it burns just as strongly in him now as it has done over the last 30 or 40 years. I mean, he would still absolutely love it. I mean, I talked to him recently when Frontier were just about to be announced by Billboard magazine, very prestigious Billboard, you know, as the number one independent concert promoting company on the planet. You know, and he was as excited about that as he would have been about anything, you know, for a very long time. And that led me to think, you know, he still really, really, really would love to have, you know, that number one record in America, or, you know, a number one record in the UK with something that was directly signed to Mushroom Records, or, well, Liberation Records, as he now calls it.
Let's talk Molly Meldrum. Now, I've met Molly a few times, and of course, he discovered Peter Andre. He had a huge career in the local Countdown with his own record label and things. But Michael and Molly are like an old married couple. They fight like cat and dog, but there's also some mutual respect there. And there's been a few fights over the years, one involving a microwave oven.
Yeah, that's
quite
funny
from the book.
That's a very funny story, and Molly also tells that in his book. And you're right. Look, it's Monday, Leo. You know, they probably love each other. You know, we'll wake up, it'll be Tuesday, they've changed their mind, they hate each other. Wednesday, they'll be ambivalent. Thursday, it'll be love. Friday, it'll be hate. You know, the one thing I think, Leo, that keeps Molly and Gudinski together is their mutual love of the St Kilda Football Club. But the story with the microwave is hysterical, because after Countdown, Gudinski and Molly formed a record label venture together called Melodeon Records. Mm-hmm. It was very much to pursue Molly's taste in music, which was sort of lots of haircuts, lots of dance music. You know, it was Roxas, it was Peter Andre, Indecent Obsession, those sort of bands. And the story is that there was a big function in Melbourne which was meant to be a celebration of Melodeon. Molly assumed that Gudinski was going to turn up and give a bit of a rah-rah, you know, rally the team speech. And Gudinski also had Jimmy Barnes in town, and Michael has a long-standing fixation with things Jimmy Barnes. So on this particular night, Michael decided that he was going to go and see a show by Jimmy Barnes. As the evening wore on and it became obvious to Molly that Gudinski was not going to turn up, Molly may have had a drink or two, but he became increasingly enraged. Then he may have had another drink or two. End result being that about 3 or 4 o'clock, he either drove or was driven, hopefully driven, around to Gudinski's house, hopped the fence, evaded the security, you know, that was around the house, hammered on the door, hysterically and crazed, demanding to see Gudinski, who was, in fact, in bed asleep. Eventually, the door was opened. Meldrum barges in, screaming at the top of his voice, threatening all sorts of whatever against Gudinski. Gudinski comes downstairs. they start grappling each other. The way it's been told is that Michael's wife, Sue, said to Michael, stop grabbing him like that, he's enjoying it. They were yelling at each other. Eventually, Gudinski grabbed Meldrum by the back of the neck, marched him into the kitchen, opened the door of the microwave oven, and put Meldrum's head in that microwave oven. It's a fair statement that the relationship that it has survived that encounter, and I suspect that might have been the most outlandish one, but, you know, we would both probably like a dollar for every time those two have had a stand-up stout about one thing or another. But at the end of the day, they kind of have always needed each other. You know, Michael needed the exposure for his acts on Countdown. Countdown needed Michael's talent and the people that he was having hit records with. So it worked like that. And, you know, they've been mates since, you know, not even the 70s. They've been mates since the 1960s. So, you know, amidst all the chaos and turmoil in both of their lives, you know, something keeps them together.
Michael seems to have his hand on the pulse quite a lot because he sold Mushroom Records at a time where music was changing, was going towards downloading and illegal downloading and stuff. So he sold off Mushroom Records. He moved on into more, I guess, touring with Frontier Touring Company. And because these days, touring is where the money is. That's where you make most of the money, is touring and publishing. More recently, the touring side of things has really taken off for him.
Yeah, the touring side, I mean, has always been big. Michael loves life on the road and he loves touring. But you're right. I mean, you know, it's also a much more high-risk business. You know, I got someone to tell me that, you know, on the very short Rolling Stones tour in 2014, I mean, the risk was $52 million, which is not a small amount of money for anybody. It's high-risk stuff. He and the people he surrounds himself with at Frontier are very, very good at it, but given that we have more concert promoters in Australia per capita than any other country, the margins on those tours are very, very small because everybody is bidding for them. So, you know, if I had $52 million, I don't think I'd be risking it on a very tight margin on a Rolling Stones tour. I think I'd just be keeping it in the bank on the short-term money market or something of that nature. But his dealings with Murdoch are fascinating, and it was great to be able to unravel a lot of those deals, because he very, well, cleverly, and I think there was some luck involved, but he managed to sell off the first 50% of Mushroom Records for, you know, a big amount of money, somewhere between $35, $40 million. But and at the time, Mushroom Records was probably the least performing of his core businesses. So as you say, he hung on to Frontier Touring. He hung on to the Premier Harbour booking agency. He kept Mushroom Publishing and all of his other ventures. He just got rid of the record label. Then we fast forward 5 or 6 years later when the record label is performing because of the global downturn in the music industry and a whole lot of other factors. The venture is performing even worse than it was when he sold the first 50%, and yet he gets even more for the second 50% than he got for the first 50%. So I think you can probably put Michael Gudinski down on a very, very, very short list, probably along with the creators of MySpace, as one of the few people that has ever actually seen to have gotten the better of Rupert Murdoch in a business deal. You know, it was a very good, particularly the second sale, a very good piece of strategic deal making by any stretch of the imagination.
Let's move on, I guess, to the music industry now. I guess these days, a lot of artists tend to go onto these music shows to get exposure, I guess, with X Factor, The Voice, Got Talent. Your thoughts on this?
I know Michael Gudinski's thoughts on it. I'm never sure that they're enduring long-term careers, really, because I don't think that they generate a short-term fan base, but whether they're, you know, whether they actually stay as fans after the TV show has worn off and, you know, and everyone has moved on to another TV show. You know, there doesn't seem to be a lot of longevity for most, and not all, most artists that come out of these talent shows. Michael has complete disdain for them and is very, I he views them very much as artificial and as not something that he personally has any interest in whatsoever. Some years ago, I was having a meeting with him in Sydney, and someone who had done relatively well in one of these television talent shows, and it was actually very talented singer. I'd been given a copy of a demo by this artist, and someone said, well, would you pass it on to Michael? And I said, look, I feel, that it's good enough that I'll see if I can give it to him. And I had a couple of other things to give to him. And so I gave him the first couple of things and he said, who's this person? And, he took the CDs. And then when I got to this other artist, I said, blah, 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 great singer, came forth on, pick a television show. And he just smiled at me and handed it back.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't say anything, but implicit, of course, was I'm not interested. I'm never going to listen to it. I don't want to know. Is that a good or a bad thing? I don't know, because he might have listened to this CD and went, "Wow, this artist is truly amazing," and done something with them in the way that if he was consistent, then he probably wouldn't have gone anywhere near. A young girl from Melbourne who was in a TV soap opera who ended up making him more money than any other artist that he's ever been involved with on a record label front. But look, that's his call. He's Michael Gudinski and we're not. So if he doesn't want to know about something that's come via a television talent show, that's his prerogative, I guess.
I guess with music these days, the whole downloading and there's the social media, and I guess the fans are expecting more from artists these days. They want to be more sort of more engaging with the artist. What do you think is the biggest mistake artists still make in the industry?
I think artists sometimes assume that the world owes them, a living and owes them an audience, that because they've made a great record that they, I still encounter artists all the time who think that their work is done when they've made a great record or CD. And I'm at pains to say to them, sadly, the reality in 2015 is your work has really only just begun. And to make a great record gets you to the starting blocks in this caper. Because, as audience members, we have such incredible ability to access any music. I mean, the music industry is supposedly on its knees. The death knell has been sounded. But hey, as a fan, when I'm just listening, there is more music around than ever before, more great music than ever before, and that makes it very, very, very difficult for a new artist to get heard in the first place. And then I think the hardest thing is, if you get heard in the first place, is then to sustain it, because everyone's attention span is so short that you can make a great record. I think of all the records that I've loved at a certain point in time, and I go, this band is just like, be it Midlake, who I know I had a fixation with, to the band called The Girls from San Francisco. I'm just thinking back to my own obsessions of over recent years, Best Coast, Fleet Foxes, all of these, the Gaslight Anthem. I could go on and on with bands that, at a certain point in time, I have considered the greatest band on the planet. And then, 6 months later or a year later, when they bring out another record, most people's attention spans have moved on and they've found someone else. So it's very hard to maintain longevity in the music industry. It's all these days about live work. I say to people on my record label, I said, look, you've got to face facts too. You're not in the music business anymore, because there isn't a music business per se. You're in the merchandising business. People are not buying CDs. They're clearly not even buying downloads to the level they used to. Music is ostensibly free. Music is always going to be free. Everything's for free if you know where to look for it. That doesn't mean that's right, but it's a reality. And so artists are going to make the majority of their money, and they're going to build their fan base by performing live. And someone recently said, look, we're actually in the t-shirt business. We give away our music to get people to come to our shows, and then hopefully they buy some t-shirts. That's a little bit cynical, but it also doesn't negate the fact that it is just a phenomenally exciting time to be a music fan. I don't go 24 hours without hearing something new that I just go, wow, how amazing is this. And yes, there were great records in the 50s and great artists in the 50s, 60s and 70s. I happen to think that once we remove the mythology from those eras, there is more great music around now than there has been at any other decade in history.
Finally, Stuart, Michael Gudinski made a very passionate speech at the Helpman Awards recently, and he gave a bit of a lashing to commercial radio in Australia for not playing enough local content. I mean, here at Joy, we play about 35% and up as far as the local content goes. We're really supportive of local music. Mm-hmm. But commercial radio doesn't seem to play much Aussie music or especially local independent music. Is that going to change?
That has bugged Michael for a long time, and he would be...
Bugged me too. The same.
Yes, and he would be acutely aware because he's also very across all of this stuff, you know, what the quota is at Joy. And, you know, I've been on FBI radio, community radio station in Sydney for over a decade. You know, he knows exactly what the playlist quota is there. You know, that's why, you know, you get to be Michael Gudinski by knowing this sort of stuff. And he would be, he's appreciative of all of that. But no, I mean, we have very, very screwed up quotas still in Australia. The fact that the quota of Australian music, I mean, it shouldn't be what stations are required to play. I mean, you know, that's annoying in the first place that you have to even tell Australian commercial radio stations that there is a quota that they have to adhere to. We shouldn't have to set a minimum for them. And the fact that, that the minimum is so low, and B, that the minimum, unlike, I think, the situation, certainly in Canada and in other countries where the quota is higher, but there's also a restriction on how far back that music can go. So if you have got a 25% quota of Canadian music, a certain percentage of that has to have been recorded within the last 2 years or something, so that there is an onus to play contemporary music and support, you know, the contemporary music industry, and not go, okay, well, we've got to play 25% Australian music. We're going to play 25% Australian music that was recorded 25 or more years ago, and then wonder why suddenly, you know, the industry is suffering. Because, you know, online is fantastic, and it is a great way to discover music. But, you know, the good old-fashioned radio, particularly in the era of streaming and on-demand radio, I mean, radio is never going to die, in that great radio still has that capacity to completely surprise you. And you're just sitting, you know, in front of a computer or in your car, you've got a presenter whose taste you trust, and suddenly, you know, you go, oh yeah, I know that song, and I say, what was that? I've never heard that before. And that thrill of hearing something on the radio, you know, as I mentioned, you know, I've spent not enough of my life on the radio. I wish I'd been on radio all my life, but I've had enough to know, and also I've spent my entire life listening to radio. And, you know, that first exposure to new music on radio is something special. And despite all the other ways that you can discover new music, you know, to my mind, it hasn't eroded, you know, the power of radio one little bit.
So the government needs to change, I guess, the policy as far as supporting new music goes.
The government's got to change the policy, but, you know, for heaven's sake, you know, the music programmers at these stations have got to change too. You should not have to be told as a music program at a major commercial radio station, or even, you know, a smaller commercial radio station in regional areas, you know, you should not be so blinkered as to not realise it's your job to know how much exciting new Australian music there is around right now. And you should not have to have a government say, well, if you don't do this, then you're going to lose your licence. I'm sorry, but, you know, from my point of view, you should be actively searching out music. Okay, be mindful of your demographic, be mindful of your audience, but don't insult them by thinking that they only want to know tried and true hits from the past. And, you know, we are not suffering in this country one iota from a lack of incredibly talented and exciting new music. So, Yeah, you know, yes, you know, legislation does one thing, but it really comes down to, I think, you know, the people that are in charge of programming radio stations like this. Heaven forbid, if that's not their job, I don't know what their job is.
Stuart, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. That's all right. The book is out. The Godfather of Australian Rock and Roll, Gedenski, is in stores right now. It's a great read. If you like music, if you like the music industry, it's a great read. Great stories, great insights into the music industry. Thanks again, Stuart.
Thank you very much, Leah.
The best for the book.
Thanks, Leah.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with Joy.